Welcome to St. Louis on the Air and today's Legal Roundtable. Lots to talk about with our panelists, including a new attempt to require voter photo identification. The St. Louis Police Chief wants to publicly identify city judges ruling on gun cases. And we'll look at how Baltimore reacted to the death of a young man in police custody and whether reaction to the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson played a role there. I'm Don Marsh. Joining me in studio are attorneys Bill Freivogel, journalism professor at SIU in Carbondale, Mark Smith, associate vice chancellor at Washington University and director of the Career Center there. Also with us is Thomas Harvey, executive director of Arch City Defenders, a nonprofit that helps people with legal problems. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thomas, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with just a rundown of what the state legislature did and did not do with regard to Ferguson, because we have some Ferguson-related issues to discuss. Just to make it simple, muni court reform did pass. It may bankrupt some municipalities, we're told, but no legislation on body cams, no police use of force legislation. County sales tax for law enforcement and public safety died, and mandated police diversity training also failed before the legislature. So, Thomas, let me begin with you. What do you make of all of this? I know you have special interest in muni court reform.
Sure. I think that SB 5 does a lot of good things, and capping revenue is one of those good things. I think more importantly, it adds some protections in the courts for the defendants who are in the courts. It puts in a provision that asks people to take into consideration, ask the courts to consider income when assessing fines. I think that's an incredibly important item. So SB 5 is a good bill. It helps. I think it also is worth noting that it only applies to traffic-related ordinances. It does not apply to non-traffic-related ordinances. So I don't think it takes a genius to figure out that if you are running these towns and you're relying on your courts for revenue, you just move to the non-traffic-related ordinances in order to collect that revenue and move away from the traffic-related ordinances.
And we've seen some indication that that's already being considered.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Mark, your thoughts?
Well, the other things that Senate Bill number 5 does is it puts some requirements in for a lot of these cities. They have to do annual budgets. They have to be audited. One of the things that I found interesting was it said that police departments have to either be CALEA certified, or I think it was the Missouri Police Chiefs Association. I'm not as familiar with the second one, but I know the CALEA certification.
What is that?
It's the Commission for Accreditation of Law Enforcement Agencies. And it says, so when I was on the police board for the city of St. Louis, we were trying to get a CALEA, and it was a big hassle. I mean, it took a lot of time and effort to do. So, and there's other things in here about they have to have use of force, written use of force policies. So it seems to me that what this law is doing is putting on a lot of these little municipalities certain minimum standards of behavior that are not going to be necessarily easy to meet. And then there's a whole provision of the bill that talks about what happens if you don't meet this, and it's basically a roadmap of how to disincorporate these municipalities. So I think it's not, and this was, a lot of this stuff was added by Deal before his little incident. But I think this could be one of the consequences of this, that you may get rid of some of these small municipalities
that are
just generating revenue through stops.
What strikes you, Bill?
Well, so I agree that the bill overall is beneficial for the people in municipal courts, the defendants in municipal courts, and should protect them against some of the abuses that, you know, Thomas and his group have talked so much about and brought to people's attention, his group being Arch City Defenders. But you know, there are some questions like the 12.5% lid on how much municipalities can make of their income from traffic fines. I mean, that falls most heavily on some of the small municipalities that have black leadership, and really just barely touches Ferguson. So even though this is sort of portrayed as being a Ferguson reform that addresses some of the issues there, if it doesn't affect Ferguson very much, but it could actually hurt some of the municipalities, the officials in the municipalities who are African American, and that can sometimes be sort of the incubator for African American leadership. The other issue I think is there's a question about whether or not you can set a 12.5% lid in St. Louis County and 20% for the rest of the state. Of course, the rest of the state claimed, well, we don't want to go live with 12.5%. And so that could be, I mean, if you talk to a person like Frank Vaderot of the Municipal Court Reform, Municipal Improvement Committee, and who's also a municipal judge, he will say that that's what's called special legislation. It's unconstitutional to have special legislation. It has to be a really strong support for why you're sort of setting a particular part of the state apart from the rest of the state. Other people say, well, it'll still pass muster and not be considered special legislation. But I think those are some questions about it.
Yeah. A challenge is quite probable, I would think.
No, I agree. I agree. But and I think it's also worth mentioning that St. Louis County is already separated out from the rest of the state in the sense that maximum fines are allowed to be $1,000 in St. Louis County and $500 everywhere else in the state. Mm-hmm. So we already have these things that actually have contributed to the problem that the legislature created.
If any of these municipalities are disincorporated, what happens to them? I mean, they don't go away. They're still there. Are they? Anybody
no,
have
they
any
go
idea?
Away. I think
well, they, these but what do they become part of
unincorporated St. Louis County? Exactly.
I think that's right.
I think it's worth noting that, you know, as we're talking about the other legislation that didn't pass, part of the reason this did pass is it plays into a longstanding political motive to get rid of some of these towns. That's not anything that our organization advocates for. We're talking about the constitutionality of the courts. But limiting the income, and as Bill rightly points out, this won't even impact Ferguson. You know, in the idea that these are mm-hmm. Ferguson-related, this won't impact Richmond Heights. This won't impact some of the West County suburbs, right? But it will impact the poor, mostly African-American communities. And I think they've got a right to say this is problematic in the sense that it only impacts us. And, oh, by the way, we didn't create this system. It was here when we finally were allowed to have political mm-hmm. power. And that's the way those towns have been run forever. And I guarantee you none of the black leaders of those towns were there when those budgets were created 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah. One thing that will affect like Richmond Heights and the West County is there's a provision in the bill that says the Supreme Court is to come up with conflict of interest rules for prosecutors, judges. You know, the Post had that big front page story on the Sunday, I don't know, a month or so ago, talking about, you know, how somebody's a judge in one municipality. Yeah. And so I think creating some rules will affect all of those municipalities. But you're right. This is going to affect those smaller ones. I mean, I hear and I've heard the same concerns, and I have that concern. But this balkanization of it just seems like it's not necessarily the best way to run a government.
Yeah, a lot of these little municipalities are not very professionally. The police departments aren't very professional. Mm-hmm. I mean, I heard Bob McCullough when he gave his speech at Mizzou a few months ago. I mean, he very specifically said we should get rid of some of these unprofessional police departments. So, yeah, the balkanization and unprofessional quality is something. But, you know, the fact that the legislature didn't pass, like, the deadly force law or the – I mean, I guess it was a good thing they didn't pass the body cam law because the body cam – I mean, to have a camera on the police officer because they were just – that law was mainly seemed to be intended to keep the footage from people until a case was over and maybe forever. But the use of force – I mean, police – so we're left with a police use of force law that lets police shoot at a fleeing felon. And so, and that is not in line with what is constitutional.
Under Missouri law, a police officer can use a deadly force almost any time in
any
situation.
To shoot at a fleeing, one of the reasons is to shoot at a fleeing felon. Mm. And the U.S. Supreme Court said 30 years ago it was unconstitutional to shoot at a fleeing felon unless they have a gun or they're dangerous. But the Missouri legislature has never brought Missouri's law up to date. And, you know, even though it was pointed out to them once again, they didn't do it.
Anything else anyone wants to add about this part of it?
I would just add that on the issue of updating legislation, I think that would be important to do to bring it in compliance with the Supreme Court. However, we all know that if a police officer says he or she is in fear of her life and the safety of others, those are the magic words to do whatever they want. And we've got real doubts. I think right now across the country, questions are being raised about the legitimacy of that claim by police officers all over. So each shooting death raises this issue again, and we keep coming back to essentially all actions by a police officer are justified by saying, I was in fear for my life or the safety of others. And it's a lot easier to bring that case when the other person is dead.
We'll be talking about some of those other cases on this broadcast as time allows. One thing I wanted to bring up and get your impression on is in Baltimore, in the police latest police custody death there, which led to demonstrations, that situation was handled very, very quickly. Do you think that Baltimore was looking at Ferguson and saying, let's not drag this thing out for weeks or even months, let's put the lid on it right now? What do you think, Mark?
I think that was part of it. I think also they were, you know, you had an African-American mayor and prosecuting attorney. So I think that changed the situation a bit. Yeah, but I think everyone's, you know, what we were just talking, I was in China. People were talking in China about, oh, how are things in St. Louis? They knew about Ferguson. I mean, it's incredible, halfway around the world.
Yeah. I was talking to David Harris, who's a law professor at the University of Pittsburgh and an expert on this, who a couple of weeks ago, who was saying that he thinks he sees in Baltimore and before it, North Charleston and Tulsa before that, a trend to prosecutors acting more quickly when the facts seem to be pretty clear. I mean, in Tulsa, some reserve officer had accidentally said he had meant to shoot somebody with a taser and shot him with a gun and killed him. We all saw the video in North Charleston, which seemed to be so blatant. And, you know, in all these cases, the prosecutor just went ahead and charged the person without first going to a grand jury. Now, some people have criticized Mosby in Baltimore.
The Baltimore prosecutor for,
you know, giving her speech sort of to the crowd and for maybe moving more quickly than she should have. The grand jury has come back with the actual charges there. You know, they dropped one of the charges that she had initially pressed, which was a false arrest. I guess the grand jury didn't see that as being as strong of a charge. But basically, still hand up an indictment that charged the officers.
It certainly did seem to put the lid on.
Yeah,
if you will.
It did.
No question about that. Better take a break. This time is moving very quickly. I'll come back to this particular theme of discussion in just a moment. It's Legal Roundtable Day. My guests in studio, as usual, Mark Smith and Bill Feivogel. Our guest today is Thomas Harvey, that is Executive Director of Arch City Defenders. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We continue our conversation. Our legal roundtable panelists are in place. We've been talking about Ferguson-related issues. Patterns and practices are getting a pretty good workout these days, not only in conjunction with Ferguson, but in Baltimore, the Justice Department is looking into the patterns and practices there. Cleveland, after the shooting there, in which the officer was acquitted, by the way, same sort of thing is going on. This is the way the Justice Department goes after these things, Bill.
Yes. So after the whole Rodney King episode back in the 90s, Congress gave the Justice Department this so-called pattern or practice authority to investigate a police department for a pattern or practice of unconstitutional policing. And, you know, they found that to be the true in Ferguson, not only with the police, but also the operation of the municipal court system. And they found that to be true in Cleveland. They're beginning their investigation in Baltimore. In Cleveland, there was this week, I guess, a consent decree that the city agreed upon. We haven't gotten to that point yet in Ferguson, but we have that in Cleveland, and it's really a pretty groundbreaking consent decree. I mean, it has very strict rules about when officers can draw their weapons. They have to make a report whenever they unholster their weapons. So they can't shoot at cars. They can't shoot from cars. I mean, this has been a big problem in Cleveland. You know, there was a recent acquittal of an officer after a big car chase where more than, I think, 100 rounds were shot into the car, with the last ones coming from an officer who jumped fairly unprofessionally onto the hood of the car and shot into the windshield.
37 rounds.
Yeah, a lot of rounds. And he was acquitted apparently because they weren't able to prove that his rounds were the ones that killed the people. The suspects because there were so many other police rounds that had been shot into the car. It seems a little bit of a strange rationale, but probably a legal one.
Any other thoughts on the Cleveland situation?
That the amount of firepower used against this, I think that incident started with a car backfiring. Police thought it was there had been shots fired, and what ensued was I think 130 some odd rounds that were
137 against 137. Two unarmed, homeless, mentally ill people whose car had backfired outside the police force. And it's one of those legal decisions that makes me want to burn my bar card listening to that judge talk about his convoluted logic in justifying the outcome in the case, which is essentially what Bill said, which is there were so many bullets fired that could have killed this person. We can't specifically say that the bullet you fired that killed this person is the one that actually struck the fatal blow. And as a result of that, you are acquitted on all these charges. And in fact, his what Bill called unprofessional behavior of jumping on the hood, the judge characterized as heroic. This was this completely twisted version of events that does not comport with what happened and gives a dangerous indication, I think, to America and Americans that whatever actions police take are justifiable. And unfortunately, the law supports that in almost all cases.
Well, it wasn't part of the discussion in this particular case also that he was a combat veteran, had been trained by the military, and this was the kind of thing that someone with that kind of training might be expected to do. Did you hear that, Mark, as well?
Yeah. No, I didn't hear that, but that would explain it. But that's, I don't think, how we want our police acting, right?
And what Thomas says is absolutely true. I mean, the Supreme Court in the, you know, the what is the law that pertains. They had a ruling in a chase. I think it was from like West Memphis into Arkansas or someplace, or vice versa. I think it was Arkansas into West Memphis, and where it was a high speed chase. The police cornered the vehicle, but it was still trying to get away, and they just pumped bullets into there until it stopped, and the people in it were killed. And the Supreme Court said that was reasonable.
You know, bad things always seem to happen as a result of a chase. Yeah. When the adrenaline was
pumping at its
highest, and almost always ends badly, whether it's a beating or a shooting, as we have seen.
So three things, other things from this consent decree in Cleveland. One was, you know, specific training on dealing with the mentally ill, and that's a big thing that police do is interact with mentally ill citizens, and that I think everyone would agree they need more training with that. It's a tough thing to do. Body cameras for everyone, and then the last one was, I'm forgetting what it was. Oh, I know, civilian investigation. So they're going to have civilians doing the investigation in addition to the police. So those are things that we keep talking about over the time that have kind of come out of Ferguson as well.
And in the same vein, we had a situation here in the last week or two in which prosecuting attorney Jennifer Joy, circuit attorney, have determined a criminal violation could not be proven in the Von Derrett Myers case. That's the young man who was killed in South St. Louis, brandishing a gun. Some people said it was a sandwich, but Jennifer Joy said that was not the case. Any thoughts about that, or should we just move on?
I mean, I think one of the most disturbing things in that report is it's clearly stated that the officer came upon Von Derrett Myers as a result of mistaken identity. That was not the person that he had initially seen. Mm-hmm. And it's yet another occasion where a police officer sees someone walking down a street. It's almost always applied to young black men. Young black man walking down a street while he's in action as a private security guard, not a police officer. His magic language is always in these police reports where these folks are always alleged to have made eye contact with me, recognized I'm a police officer, and then turned and went the other way, which then gives them reason to pursue at that point. That act, that simple act of these folks not having to walk towards a police officer if they see a police officer, right, which is supported in all the Supreme Court decisions, that led to the death of Von Derrett Myers. There were many other things that subsequently happened according to that police report, including him firing at the officer. However, the initial stop, what would have happened if that officer had just seen those guys and let them walk away? We don't have any idea what would happen. No. I think there's a good argument to say nothing would have happened that night. And instead, Von Derrett Myers ends up being killed on the streets at that night. And he wasn't even the person that the police officer suspected of being so dangerous as to not have walked towards a police officer when he saw
but
him
I thought the,
and recognized
the,
him as a police
first,
officer.
The first encounter with the guy who later, you know, was not Meyer. Didn't they also say that the suspect looked like he was holding a gun in his pants or something like that? So it's more than just not making eye contact. It's you know, this perception of a weapon.
Right. And again, this goes back to how our law is shaped and what it was required to be in a police report in order to authorize the subsequent action. And if the person isn't around later to dispute it, it's mm-hmm. a lot easier to make the case. And no one's suggesting police don't have a dangerous job, but there's a lot of authority and power given to police officers, and I think we're seeing around the country real reason to walk back some of those powers and question the application of that power.
I mean, so many of these cases that we're talking about began with police sort of making mistakes. I mean, it's easy to second guess later on. But, I mean, the Michael Brown, you know, if you talk to criminologists, they say, well, Darren Wilson should have, once he figured out that Michael Brown was involved in the convenience store thing, he should have, gone on, waited till backup arrived, then deal with it, you know, sort of de-escalate it. The teenager who had the gun in Cleveland, had the starter pistol that was mistaken. But, you know, the police come in super fast, super close, way too close to deal with it. Suddenly the kid's pointing what looks like a gun at them and they kill him. I mean, the case of down in North Charleston where the guy was running away. I mean, they had his license. They knew where to find him. They didn't have to engage in a chase, to chase him. And Baltimore too, you know, same deal.
And Kajim Powell in St. Louis, month after Mike Brown, said that part of the problem was the officers. I don't think they went too close, but they didn't give enough. I think one could say they created a more dangerous situation by not backing off a little further.
We go on and on about the number of cases that have taken place, but I wonder, Thomas, as you have indicated here, I wonder if there is likely to be some sort of reevaluation nationwide of the pattern and practice of ULA police departments because so many are caught up in this kind of thing.
I mean, I know one thing is we can't rely on the DOJ to do this all over the country, right? It's just there are too many police departments. It's incumbent upon local officials to take a hard look at this and listen to the people who are directly impacted by these practices and take – I mean, I think one of the things that came out of Ferguson and this municipal court reform is legislators listened more seriously to the voices of the people who were directly impacted by the practices of those courts. We've been talking about this stuff for years, but until people were in the streets and being taken seriously, they were not. The legislature wasn't taking it seriously either.
Well, I wonder how seriously we can say our legislature took it here in Missouri if they left everything on the table.
More seriously than in the past. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what Thomas is saying is exactly what the head of the Civil Rights Division was saying the other day, that they can't be in every law enforcement agency around. I think there are like 18,000 law enforcement agencies. There's been maybe 20 pattern or practice cases, in the last few years, which is a big increase over previous years. So the Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General, was saying people should look at this Cleveland consent decree as being the model to follow, and hopefully, and I think there's evidence that because all these cases are getting so much attention, because there was a president's council on policing, I think there is a lot of national attention that will change things.
We shall see. Let's move along. Also, law enforcement related here. I noticed that St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dotson plans to develop a new website that would rank judges by how often they give probation to people facing certain lower level felony gun charges. That's a big cause celeb for him and for Jennifer Joyce, the prosecutor, by the way. But my God, how are the judges likely to react to this? Mark, what do you think?
Well, I don't think they're going to like it. So what he's saying is he's going to create like a database where you can go search to see what they're giving. Now, there was a letter to the editor from a public defender saying that, our judges are tougher and convict more people and put more people in prison than the rest of the state. I don't know. I haven't looked at the data. But I think, you can sense the frustration that Dotson and Jennifer Joyce have when they go, because they're out in these community meetings where the judges aren't, and the community members are saying, this person, we know, and the alderman now is telling people you should go to court, and then they get probation or something. I'm sure that's not all the time, but the wrath is directed at the police chief and Jennifer Joyce, so...
What do you, Thomas, what do you think of this tactic?
I mean, we want people who are first-time offenders to get probation. As a, as a country, that's a policy that we agree with almost universally, unless it's applied to young black men. And in that case, we want the books thrown at them. We want them to go to jail right away. These are C&D-level felonies. Virtually any person alleged to have committed a C&D-level felony or first-time offender would be given probation. And that's what should happen. If no one is pretending there isn't aren't problems with gun violence in the city of St. Louis, but I don't, and maybe you should have another panelist on here to talk about the statistics and the power of locking everyone up. Of course, we could lock everyone up and then we'd have no crime, but that's not the country we want to live in, right? Right. That's not the world that we've all agreed to live in. So,
and we already lock up way too much of our population compared to other countries.
We already incarcerate six times the number of African-American men in the United States than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. Mm-hmm. Do we need more young black men in prison? I don't think so. And most of the offenses that we incarcerate people on are nonviolent offenses. The FBI estimates it's 94% of all people in jail are in jail for nonviolent offenses.
I think per capita we have more people in prison than China or North Korea.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of holding judges up to public ridicule for being too quote unquote soft on crime. I think that's how we got into the situation that Thomas and you are describing of too many people locked up.
Yeah. Moving on now to get to something else that's gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of weeks, and that's the shooting incident in Texas outside the place where they were having a cartoon contest, Muhammad being the subject of the cartoons. Pamela Geller is the person who got this thing started, the organizer of the contest, and she's founder of two groups that have been identified as hate groups, anti-Islamic groups. My question is, given our First Amendment, are hate groups protected by freedom of speech?
Yes. I think they are.
that's an easy answer.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I mean, that's why that Westboro Baptist Church gets to come out and say really hateful things, and it's easy to protect speech that you agree with. It's really hard to protect speech that you find hateful and but we do.
The Ku Klux Klan gets to put on their robes and ride.
Nazis get to march through Skokie, right? Right.
I know all of that, but here it was a situation in which I think almost everyone knew that there was going to be a violent aspect to this particular contest, and that therefore you have to be a little cautious when First Amendment or not.
So you can't if you're the Ku Klux Klan, you can't like burn across like right in front of an African American in a threatening manner, or you can't stand in front of a rabble rousing crowd in front of City Hall and say let's go get it, let's go get them. So you can't do that. But this is but you also can't. You can't allow a heckler's veto. You can't just because you know that that maybe there's some Muslim who is going to feel as though this is blasphemy and needs to react violently. I mean, you can't cut off the speech that caused them to feel that way. It's not the speaker's fault. It's the hecklers or the attackers' fault. So this is protected speech. It's nasty speech. I think we should all denounce it. She's definitely anti-Muslim. But
bad judgment and moral morally wrong doesn't violate the First Amendment. So I think she's both of those things, but she's not violating the First Amendment.
Okay, let's move on. John Deal, we had to get to this in one way. And Bill, I'll turn to you for this as the longtime distinguished journalist that you have been. This incident involved the salacious texting between Deal and a young woman. She's 19 years old. She identified herself through her lawyer when this story came to light. She was complicit, I guess, in this. She was not a victim, although you can argue she was because she's 19, he's 49. But the fact is,
she's the intern and he's the boss.
He's the intern, you got a power issue
there, too.
Right. There's no question about that. My question is, releasing the name. Most news organizations did not, although I think the Post-Dispatch showed her picture at least. Your thoughts about that? Is there a legal requirement that news organizations not use names in situations such as this?
I don't think there's a legal requirement. I think it would be more of an ethical and decision. I think it was appropriate not to use her name because of she was 19 and because of this power relationship. I thought it was. I thought the the university refused to release her name based upon the federal Educational Privacy Act, and I thought, well, maybe you could make that argument. Also, but then the Post-Dispatch, I think, filed a Sunshine Act request asking for the names of the interns in the Missouri legislature, and the legislature tried to use that same federal Educational Privacy Act as a reason not to release the name of interns working for the state. That seemed to me a little bit a little bit crazy.
Even though she had released the name. The name had come out, been made public.
Well, I don't know. I mean, what I saw was that she had answered questions for some reporters, had referred people to her lawyer, and the lawyer and she had asked that her name not be that she not be brought into it and that her privacy be protected. And I think it's appropriate for a newspaper to decide to protect the privacy, but it's not a legal requirement.
Any other thoughts on that?
Well, another issue I think that's kind of interesting, you know, this is what I spend a lot of my time doing at the university with the Career Center is, you know, she's an intern. So if I'm this university, and this is it sounds like it's not just like something where she got out and it's university sponsored. This could be a Title IX violation. So they've got I thought it was interesting that they pulled all their interns quickly. I heard there was another incident with another legislator just recently in the last day or two where interns got pulled and there might be something brewing there. I don't know. But yeah, so you've got possible violations, you know, because I think you could make a good case this was sexual harassment given the power dynamics. And I think the university, it seems to me they did everything right, to deal with it. But if they ignored it, there would have been a problem there.
Well, you've spent the last couple of weeks in China and you've been able to follow this story.
The internet's a wonderful thing.
Have to take another break. Let's do that now. Come back, continue our conversation with our legal roundtable panelists, and we'll take as many of your calls as we can as time allows. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our legal roundtable panel discussion today. Before we continue, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. A group seeking to recall Ferguson Mayor James Knowles III plans today to hand in a petition containing more than 1,800 signatures. They had wanted to submit the document earlier this week, but were unable to meet with the city clerk. U.S. Steel says it will not be temporarily shutting down its plant in Granite City. The company has announced it will continue to operate one blast furnace and another will be off while new equipment is installed. The steelmaker had announced plans in March to temporarily idle the plant in a move that would have affected roughly 2,100 workers. And new casinos would be added throughout the state under legislation expected to be introduced today in the Illinois Senate. Also, passage of the bill is one of the requirements of the proposal by the Casino Queen in East St. Louis to purchase Fairmount Racetrack. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Okay, back to our legal roundtable panel discussion. We had just been talking about the John Deal situation. We have a couple of callers, other things I want to get to, but let's bring in Jerry and O'Fallon, who wants to talk about John Deal. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hey, good morning. I find it more reprehensible that, unless I'm mistaken, John Deal was involved, his law firm, in defending the owners of the Bridgeton landfill. And, in fact, I think there was legislation that was they were trying to get through the our state legislature to shield the company from any future liability, even though we've seen confirmation that there are carcinogens that are escaping from there, and the whole situation has a lot more damage to our community than any kind of texting he could do.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Thoughts?
I mean, I hear what he's saying. I worked at one of those big law firms. You know, just because your firm is doing something doesn't necessarily mean you're involved, doesn't even necessarily mean you know about it. I may be being very naive about it, to assume that those lawyers didn't talk to him, but I would assume they would put up, some barriers between the lawyers working on that case and the former representative there.
Yeah, I just don't know enough details to comment.
Right. Well, let's take another call, and we'll bring in Jay calling from Normandy. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen. I understand from you all talking about guns, I understand that with the passage of Prop 5, Amendment 5, that that we have felons driving around the streets of St. Louis with guns, and that the Chief Dotson and the prosecutor and some other prosecutors in other nearby counties, I think St. Charles County, that they're not able to go after these hoodlums with guns, or felons, I should say, with guns. And I just point out, do you guys not read the paper that I read or listen to Channel 4 News? The shootings that I see or hear about going on are not by police. 97% of them are by the kids you all are talking about, and that's who's shooting other kids. And the bullets are flying and people are dying on I-44 and all over. So I'd like you to respond to that.
Thanks very much, Jay. I think we're well aware of that, but in the context of what we were talking about here, we're focusing on the police shootings.
Yeah, I mean, I think the caller is correct.
Sure.
That an awful lot of young people, and especially African American people, are dying from the gun violence in America's cities. And I think that the proposition that was passed, I think a lot of prosecutors and police are concerned that it creates it could create the kind of constitutional right that could make it difficult to enforce some statutes.
And one of the reasons police are reacting as they do in some of these cases is because of their respect for the firepower on the other side. I mean, some of these kids are walking around with weaponry that is just extraordinarily, what's the word I'm looking for? I mean, it's not, no longer just a six-shooter. It's automatic weapons that can do a great deal of damage very, very quickly.
I'd just like to say something about this comparison between citizens killing one another and police killing citizens. I think it's very important to distinguish that those are very different questions, right? Like we authorize and we grant police this immense power to have them kill citizens in our name, essentially. I think it's right for us to call into question that killing. We prosecute killings among citizens, and what we're focusing on and what we've been talking about is what's the scrutiny level we're going to give to police-involved shootings and police-involved killings. I think it's important that those are not – that's not an apples-to-apples comparison.
Right. Because the citizens, if we catch them, they go to jail and – yeah.
All right. Back to the phones. We'll bring in Cly calling from St. Louis. Cly, go ahead.
Wow, I was hoping that I wasn't the next person behind that last one. My call is on a similar subject, but it's more of a trust and how do we as a society address this issue? I've got a 4-year-old grandson, and every time he sees a police car now, he's panicked. He's an African American male. He's 4 years old. At 4 years of age, he is convinced that the police are going to kill him. Now, I'm raising this boy to be respectful. My phrase to him all the time is, I'm raising a man, not a thug. But having said that, when I tell him when he sees the police car that he's safe, I'm going to be honest. I don't believe it.
That's a very powerful statement, I think, that you made, and it's very sad that you feel that way, and for good reason. I just wrote a story about the reaction of African Americans and whites in the area around the Brown killing. And the attitude of African Americans towards how much they trust police and how much they respect police authority have gone down substantially since the shooting. It's partly just a rational response. I mean, you talk to African Americans who have young African American men and African Americans who have young sons, have teenage sons, and there's the stories are just legion about unfair stops that mm-hmm. are racially profiled, and so I'm glad you're telling your son to respect the police, but it's also a really serious problem.
Yeah, it's not, and it's, I think, a very common story. I've heard this. I have two teenage boys. They're big kids. I've told them what to do, you know, turn on your light, keep your hands. But I know their situation is going to be very different than if they were African-American. And I think, you know, we have this with our WashU students. They talk about it. And I think it's I'm not sure what the solution is.
Well, go ahead, Thomas.
Well, I was just going to say I agree completely with what the caller said. I think it was Clyde. And each time we see a young African-American man killed by the police, I wonder what people in Clyde's position, how they manage to go on raising their children with any sense of and even sort of healthy respect for the law. Like it's day after day, story after story, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's education, whether it's housing, where on the front page of the newspaper, there's a clear, direct message that our society doesn't care about poor black people in America. And in the ultimate sign of that is we justify the action of the police in virtually every case in spite of sometimes 137 bullets being fired into a stop car with two unarmed mentally ill people. So I don't. I mean, I think what Bill said is right. It's a completely rational reaction to fear the police at this point. And the police, when they say things like "we wish we could recruit more African Americans to the police force," well, I don't think there's any accident as to why they can't recruit more African Americans to the police force. Who would want to do this job given their impression of what the job is at this point? Correct or not, right? But at this point, it's a generational challenge to overcome what I think is a reasonable impression of what the police do to African Americans in this community and in the United States.
We've had young black men on this program who say if they would join the police force, they would be considered traitors in their own community. That's the way they would be reacted to. Okay, and another thing, I would just point out that this distrust between the police and the African American community predates the Michael Brown shooting.
Well,
it's a good long time. It's been going on for a long while, but it just hasn't been reported as perhaps it might have been.
And I want to just follow up on that real quick. Is like, there's this notion that we see often in police advertising saying, you know, like, let us know. We can't investigate the crime because people won't tell, and talk about this idea of snitches. And now I think there's an equal and I think just as important notion being raised about police saying we're good and there are some bad apples, and African-American community, and I think all of us should be saying, okay, you let us know who the bad folks are in your police department too. I think that's something just as if we're going to ask the community mm-hmm. to say, turn over your bad apples, the police department ought to be turning over its bad apples also.
Right. Moving on to something else, unless any of you gentlemen have something, we'll move on to something going on here in the city of St. Louis and in a much broader way going on nationally, even internationally. I'm talking about the debate in Washington over the Patriot Act, extending that. NASA's harvesting of information. But here in St. Louis, there's a growing concern about this electronic device that St. Louis City Police apparently have called the Stingray cell phone tracking apparatus, whatever that involves. But apparently they can listen in on conversations or identify people and places where people are through this apparatus. It's a wonder if that's a violation of Amendment 9 on reasonable search and seizure. Some people think it is. What do you guys think?
Well, I think it potentially could be. So this is the Stingray technology. I guess it is a device. It's maybe not much bigger than a suitcase, so it's very mobile, that can act like a cell tower and cause nearby cell phones to send information on their location. It's used, according to the judges in St. Louis City and the police, it's used primarily, although not entirely, to try to locate a cell phone that has been stolen. So, you know, the person who actually owns a cell phone is certainly, you know, happy to have that try to be located. But there are several cases, several prosecutions that now have been thrown out, and it seems as though maybe they've been thrown out because the St. Louis police don't want to answer questions about how the technology works. And the reason they don't want to do that is they've agreed to an FBI protocol that says you can't release this information because it's national. This technology is national security related. And if the way in which it worked were disclosed, it could easily be finessed.
Speaking of national security, what do you make of this debate over the Patriot Act and extending that? And there was a case in a federal court in which the Second Circuit ruled that the heart and soul of the so-called Patriot Act is constitutionally flawed, that gathering this information and allowing snooping by phone is not constitutional. What impact that judge's ruling is going to have on the Congress position on the Patriot Act extension? Thoughts?
Well, so there's going to be a vote I think this Sunday. So Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which is what is used by the NSA to justify this bulk collection of metadata about Americans' telephone calls, is set to sunset at the end of this month.
June 1st, I think.
If it's not renewed. And to this point, it has not been renewed. And if one senator will not go along on Sunday, and Rand Paul would seem like a possibility, and there are probably some others as well, then they have to wait at least 30 hours before they could vote, even if they have the 60 votes to defeat a filibuster. So in that case, the program would end and would have to be started again if Congress were to approve it. I mean, some people wouldn't see it as a reform, but the measure that is being considered by Congress, it's passed the House and it's in consideration in the Senate, would be for not the government to have all these phone records, but rather the private telephone companies. And since the private telephone companies aren't covered by the Fourth Amendment, and that would potentially solve the legal problem that Court of Appeals found. The Court of Appeals that's the first appellate court that has ruled on the bulk metadata collection. So that was an important opinion. Plus, there were some of the judges on that panel were notable judges. But there, I think the D.C. Court of Appeals is we're waiting for an opinion. So we could have different opinions as to whether or not Section 215 is being authorized this data. What the Court of Appeals basically said was that. The NSA was collecting more data than was quote unquote relevant to their mm-hmm. inquiry, and so they didn't really have statutory authority that lets them collect relevant data doesn't let them collect as much data as they were collecting. Section 215 also has other provisions that the NSA folks think are important. Roving wiretaps, so against a terrorist who is throwing away a lot of cell phones, and lone wolf authorization to go after a person who doesn't have a contact with a terrorist organization. So that would go out the window also.
Right. It's a complicated deal.
Yeah.
There is no question about it. One other thing I wanted to get to in the 2 minutes that we have left is John Ashcroft's son, Jay, who is an attorney, is proposing a constitutional amendment to require voters to show a government-issued photo ID before casting a ballot. This is the issue that just doesn't seem to go away,
right.
And people on the right side of the political spectrum seem intent on making this happen one way or another.
Yeah, it's come up a lot. It's happened in other states, Texas, North Carolina, much more restrictive voter ID laws to solve a problem that some people suggest it's a solution looking for a problem. And so some people ascribe other intents to it. I think, though, Ashcroft's son is running for Secretary of State, right? Hasn't the Democratic candidate also come out in favor of something like this?
I don't know the Democratic candidate,
surprised.
But the other – isn't it a competing Republican candidate?
I thought
possibly?
It was a Democrat, too, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But we already have some kind of voter. This is just – even more intense.
It just can't seem to make its way through the state legislature. But
Nixon would veto it, I would assume. But
case where some folks use constitutional amendments to bypass that mm-hmm. probability
right,
or possibility that the governor would issue a veto. Just a few seconds left. A final thought from anyone before I have to say goodbye?
Well, I just point out that the reason that this issue comes up is that the Missouri Supreme Court ruled in, I think it was 2006, that the state constitution made the voter photo ID requirement was unconstitutional in the state constitution.
The U.S. Constitution. Right?
We have to leave it at that. Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Thomas Harvey, thanks so much for being with us. A lot of stuff to talk about today.
We'll ask you to join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk about Circus Flora's 2015 production, One Summer on Second Street, a St. Louis Symphony Maryville University partnership helping North St. Louis middle schoolers deal with trauma through songwriting. And he'll take a look at a controversy in Alton about whether a tattoo shop belongs in the Arts District. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with former Major League Baseball catcher Benji Molina, brother of Yadier, about his new memoir. We'll also take a look at what was and wasn't accomplished in the current session of the Illinois State Legislature. It ends on Sunday. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Programs produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Evita Caldwell, Aaron Dorr, Anya O'Connor, and Spencer Reed. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.